is now the time to create apps for AR.
If you recall the Google Glass days, they had the little translation app. And so you could look at a street sign and it would auto-translate it for you. I got to play with that. Blew my mind. I also got to play with the Microsoft HoloLens, which was AR. Blew my mind. And I never got to play with Magic Leap, but I'm sure I would have loved it. And so it's just, it's funny how so many things that I don't like to use, like Concur, kind of just like stay alive in the world of technology. And some things that were so great didn't quite make it. But I think we've now reached the point when the hardware's gotten good enough. There's enough good apps. Yeah, I think we're probably about at the point when AR and VR are going to have enough consumer buy-in to be worth building on top of.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. Cloud devs. Building the best remote team is tough, but you don't have to do it alone. Visit clouddevs.com/twist for an unbeatable offer on hiring elite LATAM talent today. And Sprig, the product experience platform that generates AI-powered opportunities to continuously improve your product at scale. Visit sprig.com/twist to book a demo and get a $75 gift card.
All right, everybody, welcome to This Week in Startups. I'm Jason Calacanis, he's Alex Wilhelm, and we're here to go through all the news that is important to startup founders, venture capitalists, and tech enthusiasts, I guess, more broadly. What do we got on the docket, Alex? Lot to talk about today.
Yeah, so over the weekend, we saw SB 1047, the California AI regulation bill that everyone had an opinion about, got vetoed. We'll dig into why we care and why it matters. Then we're going to talk a little bit about AR and VR headsets and what Jason is calling the startup graveyard. Then Swiggy's IPO and, depending on time, a couple of notes on the open AI revenue trajectory, and then a new Twist 500 company. So, Jason, quite a lot to get into, but before we start, we had a request from the friends and family out there listening to the show. I think this may have come from YouTube, but on an episode a couple episodes ago, you said we are on the precipice of the greatest super cycle in the history of business. And this person asked us to unpack that a little bit. So I figured let's start there.
Okay. So let's define what a super cycle is. A super cycle is a technology comes out and it's so powerful, it's so transformative that it will push a bunch of founders to be part of that wave of technology. Fairly obvious when I mention them what a super cycle might be. The PC revolution, when people started having PCs at their offices in the 80s, well, that meant they needed Lotus 123. They needed something to do with this computer. So Lotus 123, Microsoft Word, all these products started coming out. Then we had the network revolution and connecting all these computers together. Now you could do, instead of just Microsoft Word, you could do document management. You and I could work on versions of a document, which became like super important for lawyers. And then eventually the idea that you had versions of a document is something that everybody, a college student, high school student might have the ability to understand. Other super cycles, obviously the internet. And then we had cloud computing, as you know, mobile. And then there were other things that didn't become super cycles. VR, AR, very famously, three or four times we've had to tried to start that up. This transformative technology didn't work. AI, we had it happen maybe 10 times in the last, I don't know, 50 years, really, like even the 70s and 80s. And now it's finally hitting. Batteries, sensors, the iPhone, smartphones, people would probably consider that a revolution. You look at that super cycle of battery and sensor technology enabled everything from smart glasses, which we'll talk about today, as well as electric cars, right? The battery packs on the original electric vehicles were literally like the battery packs, I think, from smartphones and laptops. So now here we are. We've defined what a super cycle is. We're obviously in the AI super cycle. And what I think makes this the greatest super cycle of all is how much it will impact every aspect of our lives. The smartphone was the previous one that impacted every part of our life, but the PC didn't, right? Cloud computing didn't. They affected a lot of our lives, but not every aspect of our lives. And people, you know, this would be the, I guess, the smartphone would be the one I'd say was the biggest super cycle along with the internet of our lifetime. So we have those two, and then this one, AI. what's going to happen, I believe, in this super cycle is massive job displacement, the static team size, and then bionic, you know, augmented humans, you know, somebody with AI being able to do the jobs of 5 or 10 people, people who don't know how to use AI doing the jobs of, instead of one person, 1/10 of a person,
yeah.
Right? So, okay, here we are. That's why I think this super cycle is the one to look out for. Now, in a selfish way, as an investor, I'm looking at it saying, if I can invest in and help, I don't know, 100 startups a year, maybe 200 even, if I get more ambitious and we have the quality there, over the next 5 years, if I can place 1,000 startup bets, which I'd like to do in the next 5 years, I have to figure out how to ramp that up intelligently. In those 1,000, I've got a good chance of catching in that debt the next Amazon, Uber, Airbnb, Robinhood, you know, let's call it a $10 billion, $100 billion, or maybe even a $1 trillion company. And so when investors look at a super cycle, that is what I think defines a super cycle. And I think that's what makes this the greatest time ever to invest in technology companies, public or private, and the best time ever to start one.
Yeah. So I agree with all of that. But to me, I think we're still underselling the point in time, because everything you said is true, but I wonder if we're not going to see concurrent other super cycles. Like, I think when self-driving cars, give them 3 more years, really reach a greater level of market penetration, I think that could revolutionize how goods are moved, how people are moved, how friends move around, where we live, how we live. So I wonder if that couldn't also be a super cycle that could land at the same time as AI. And then frankly, I would say fusion, if it works out. If we do get to net positive, you know, but I mean, can you imagine a world when AI is doing everything from robotics to, you know, AI SDRs, we have unlimited clean energy and the cars are driving themselves? I mean, that's science fiction.
I mean, it's science reality. Science fiction is always like the roadmap of technologists. And so here we are. I do think fusion would create a super cycle. Unlimited energy means unlimited clean water.
Yep.
Unlimited clean water. And heat means unlimited food, because that's what photosynthesis is like, you know, light plus water. So, okay. And then robotics, and AI combined. So I'd put AI as like a subsection of that would be free transportation, or, you know, close to free transportation and free fuel. Oh my Lord, you're correct. There are super cycles coming that I think are going to, dare I say, change everything. And then the question is, how do you play a super cycle? Can you be too early or too late for it? The two stories I wanted to talk to you about today are two that really dovetail with the AI super cycle in a major way. Founders, do you want to sell to bigger customers? I know you do. You got to get that ACV trending up, and you want to push your churn down, right? Sounds good. But to sell to those big buyers, you need to clear all of these compliance checks. You know that. That means you got to have things like SOC 2 sorted out. What's SOC 2? It's a standard and ensures that companies keep their customer data safe. And if you aren't SOC 2 compliant, you can kiss those big deals goodbye. You're not going to land the Lighthouse customers. You're not going to be able to operate at the highest end of the market. But Vanta makes it really easy for you to get and renew your SOC 2 compliance. On average, Vanta customers are compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. It can take months without Vanta. And they automate compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, and more. So you can sell to bigger customers in whatever markup your startup is going after. Vanta is going to save you hundreds of hours of work and up to 85% on compliance costs. Stop slowing your sales team down and use Vanta. Get $1,000 off at vanta.com/twist. That's vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2.
Yeah, let's start with SB1047. So if you have been under a rock for a long time.
Is that a Star Wars character? That's a Star Wars character. I think it was in The Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, it was green. It was shaped as 3 balls stacked on one on top of each other. No, it's a bill. It's entitled the Safe and Secure Innovation for Frontier Artificial Intelligence Models Act, because everyone knows that people who legislate are great at naming things. Jason, the news over the weekend is that SB 1047 in California was vetoed by Governor Gavin Newsom. And up went the fireworks. But take us behind the scenes. What was the reaction on your group chats that we don't get access to?
Basically nothing. People have come to the conclusion that our government is captured here in the United States largely, and that the winning hand is going to be no AI regulation. In Europe, probably be the opposite. There, you know, you have, if anything, business is captured by government in Europe, and it'll go the opposite way. So I think it'd be a tale of two cities.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I want to go over a little bit of what happened, why we're afraid, and then we're going to wrap the section with what it means for startups. So stick with us here. Jason, how much about SB 1047 should we tell people? Should we give them like a rundown of what it was going to do and the concerns about it? Or do you want to be a little bit faster?
I think
today?
That's, well, I think we should explain maybe the top two or three concepts of how they were going to throttle, monitor AI, because there are fears that people have, and the fears should be real. The fear of job displacement is obvious. We're going to have on 1010 the robo taxi from Tesla. We have BYD, Waymo, and four other companies partnering with Uber on automation. So the idea of being a taxi driver or a truck driver is going to radically change in our lifetime. And it might change in, I would say, between 5 and 10 years, depending on the jurisdiction. So that's very real. Now, what the government should do about that, if anything, I kind of wonder, as a libertarian leaning kind of person, like with coal workers, I kind of feel like it's a small number of people that drive a lot of votes. Maybe, you know, in society, we just say, here's, you know, when these markets come apart, just here's some training maybe. And if you choose to take it, you know, here's $5,000-$10,000 worth of training, a nice thing, a mitzvah for the government to do. But otherwise, you have to be responsible for your own future and see that coming and make changes in your career choices and or spending as an individual, right? Like, this is part of living in a free dynamic society as opposed to a protectionist society. So anyway, let's go through the top two or three things. The fears are real. I don't think the fear of like, they're going to come and kill us is real. I think that's like the 1% science fiction 10, 20 years from now. But I do think the job displacement is the one that unions and individuals should actually realistically care about.
Well, that, I think, breakdown is why some people were opposed to SB 1047, because this is the bill all about catastrophic risk. And so what that means is what they called critical harms. It was talking about like avoiding AI systems, helping create WMDs that result in mass casualties or mass casualties and mass damage from cyber attacks. So essentially, this was the bill that was thinking about the far future, the biggest models, and the biggest risks. And that is how it was set up. So one of the reasons why this bill was so controversial is that it had a definition of essentially what models had to obey its rules. And those were ones that had computing that were built using computing power over 10 to the 26th integer or floating point operations, or that cost $100 million or more to make. So Jason, you know, this bill wasn't about job protection. It wasn't about rescaling. It wasn't about UBI. It wasn't about the stuff that I think you and I really care about, which is people. It was about trying to put some guardrails in place to prevent AI from the future from becoming Terminator. And that's what I thought was kind of silly, because it felt like it was waving at a future that we should maybe be afraid of, and then trying to harm the present to get us there. And the way it did that was essentially adding civil and criminal penalties to companies that make AI models over a certain size if they did not follow the rules, preventing misuse of cover models, building kill switches, filing lots of paperwork, showing code, listing where they got data, and so forth. So there was a lot of regulations for these large models. And now, no.
Yeah. So if you were to regulate large models in California, and California is on the vanguard of creating regulations and creating new trends. So just having been a California resident for, I guess, maybe close to 20 years of my life, and a New Yorker for 30, and now coming from the proud hill country of Texas outside of Austin, what I'll say is, you know, California is beautiful in that, you know, yoga, crystals, organic food, you know, a lot of trends start here. And you can goof on it, but that's part of the freewheeling spirit that I loved about California. It accepted anybody, even to the point of absurdity. I want to be recognized as a puppy. You know, like literally we'll have regulation that like people who think they're furry animals need to be protected, right? It's lunacy. You know, you might put it under woke. I thought it was kind of comical until maybe it wasn't. But, you know, it's great that we got yoga. It's great that we got meditation, and people would take that seriously and be part of the avant-garde. And then on the East Coast, what I found growing up, cynicism, right? And then we just have to, and people will be cynical about yoga or whatever until they try it. And then 10 years after, it's popular in the West Coast, it's popular on the East Coast. Putting that together, it's a long-winded way of saying, I think California likes to try like regulations and getting up in people's business in a very big way. Texas, Florida, live and let live. New Hampshire, live free or die. There's like lots of different flavors in our country. And so California's going to California. And this is obviously like kind of ridiculous to create all this regulation. I know some people, like probably Sam Altman and OpenAI or Microsoft, might actually want this because it creates $100 million a year in legal fees or $10 million a year in legal fees that will stifle other companies. So, or make it impossible for startups to compete because the legal bill would be greater than their team size and their staffing bill. So anyway, good riddance to this one. Europe will probably have 10 times worse. And the focus, I think, that the government needs to look at is what are we going to do if we have cataclysmic job displacement? And you know what? We had cataclysmic job displacement multiple times in our history. Wars, COVID, stock market crashes. And we have this concept of unemployment. We have this concept of stimulus that we dropped people, you know, $1,000 on people's heads like three or four times. So I'm not worried about it. If we have cataclysmic job displacement, we're a strong country with the ability to manage it. I do think it could create civil unrest, though. I'll leave it.
Yeah, there's always a risk of that in the near term. And, you know, it's what's funny is talking about this stuff. It's how broad the impacts of AI could be. And therefore, that's how scattershot the AI regulations are. So when Gavin Newsom vetoed SB 1047, he also kind of flexed that he had signed a lot of AI bills. I'm not going to go through them all by name and number here, Jason, to save everybody, but they were working on things in California, like not using AI to create child sexual abuse material. Good. You know what I mean? No cloning dead people without permission. Pretty reasonable. Disclosing that an ad was AI edited. Reasonable. So there have been in California some nibbles at AI regulation. But to me, they land on the side of use. Do not misuse this technology that has been built because that is the risk versus looking at the models themselves. And that to me was always the mismatch with this bill versus everything else. Because we can sit down and say, hey, let's not let teens make sexual deepfakes of one another for about 8,000 different reasons, right? No one's really going to be opposed to that except for the most hardcore libertarian, but there's like seven of those. So we don't need to worry about it too much. But to me, the idea of regulating at the model level was a big mistake.
I think, by the way, that's like a really great point that I didn't even get to, which is, you know, Esther Dyson, who was a mentor of mine when I started in publication. She had a publication, Release 1.0. She always made time for me. Thank you, Esther, for that. And, you know, it really informed a lot of how I think about technology reading Release 1.0 that she did with Jerry Mikulski and her and you know, she said, you don't have to use this technology. You could opt out of it. If you disagree with what the company's doing, and you could not buy their product. So if you disagree with Seed Oil Hills or you disagree with Microsoft and how they're running things, there are alternatives. Vote with your dollar. And then the second thing she had said to me at some point was, are we going to blame Volvo when a bank robber steals a Volvo and robs a bank? Or is there like another place to put the blame as opposed to Volvo? And so, you know, that analogy is a really good one until it isn't. You know, if somebody makes an AI drone specifically designed to target a person by photo and murder them by attaching like a gun to them, you know, okay, slightly different, but the drone and the gun, you know, that you use for hunting or that you use for making pictures, those people maybe shouldn't be at fault if a lunatic puts a gun on a drone. I'll just, you know, end my TED talk there, but I do think you're right. And it is one of the arguments I had with Lina Khan. I love when Lina Khan takes action against specific things. Like, I don't know, the app stores are a good example, the tax in app stores or bundling. Those seem like really interesting tactical things to go after. Philosophical things, I think you get yourself in trouble, right? Because now you're kind of like, philosophically, I want to stop technology and progress. Or philosophically, I don't believe people should be able to own a firearm. Like, it just kind of shuts the discussion down. And that's why I wanted you to just break down tactically like you did wonderfully here. Are you looking for an unbeatable deal on senior talent? Well, if so, you need to look outside of your borders. According to G2, Cloud Devs is the best place to hire top LATAM talent. That's Latin America, a market with millions of developers. Cloud Devs is the largest pool of Latin American talent with over 10,000 senior engineers who are rigorously vetted for communication and problem-solving skills. And now LatHire by Cloud Devs can even fill non-technical roles. Very interesting, from accounting to graphic design with elite LATAM talent. Giants like Coinbase are choosing Cloud Devs because its talent is matched with your time zone, and it's up to 80% cheaper than a local hire, with the same Silicon Valley standards. So here's your call to action. Because they're such big fans of the show, Cloud Devs is offering Twist listeners an exclusive pay what's fair deal. Instead of their usual fee, only pay what you feel the talent is worth for a limited time only and exclusively for our listeners. Just go to clouddevs.com/twist. to pay what's fair for your next five-star hire.
Let me grab just a couple of quick things before we move on. First of all, we have a tweet from Martin Casado from Andreessen Horowitz. I just want to show this to point out the tone of many VCs who were very public about this bill. And of course, Andreessen Horowitz, a major investor in AI companies. So Martin says, unbelievably grateful to Gavin Newsom for doing the right thing and vetoing SB 1047. This is the path to sensible AI policy and maintaining California's global leadership. I liked that. And then I'm going to grab one more. AI funds Andrew Ng, he also the co-founder of Coursera, made a very important point, Jason. He said, looking ahead, let's keep on protecting AI open source and innovation. And one concern that people had was, okay, so these rules that SB 1047 would have put into place with penalties and regulations and boards, all were aimed at for-profit companies, it felt like. So what do you do if it's you and I passing, you know, code back and forth on GitLab or GitHub? Who's in charge there? Who has to report?
Yeah, who's responsible? Yeah.
And people were worried that it was going to chill the heck out of open source AI development. Well, now we don't have to worry about that. And I think that's good for startups because it means they don't have to go pay OpenAI for access. They can just fire up a Llama model and then run it themselves and off to the races. So I
encourage them to do, by the way. Finish your thought and then I'll tell you why.
Well, I'll just say that we now have a competition in the market between the for-profit AI companies and the open source market. And what happens with more competition? More good products. So we're going to have greater friction, greater tension, more competition. I just love it. I think this is a net good. But why do you recommend open source?
Yeah, I was going to say it would be really great for the startup community to build everything with the ability to unplug and plug into, you know, the open source community. And that's what I heard from a lot of folks building startups. We're using ChatGPT, but we expect to be screwed by them. This is like the private chat. So we don't trust certain people at OpenAI to be reliable. And in the way that people don't trust Zuckerberg, right? And if you look at Zynga, you know, Mark Pincus had his business destroyed by his quote unquote friend, Mark Zuckerberg, who was like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to destroy Zynga Poker Farmville. And then they have to pay us if they want people to play that game. And then you had Mark Zuckerberg talk about how bummed out he was about the Apple changes and how he had to be like subservient to the platform of the iPhone. And I tweeted like how ironic that was, considering he destroyed Zynga and countless other startups, to which Mark Pincus was like, yeah, how does it feel, Zuck, to be Zucked? And so you don't want to get Zucked, which rhymes with another word, and you don't want to get Altman'd, I think. And that doesn't mean I, you know, think Altman is not trustworthy, but a lot of people have said to me, I don't trust Sam Altman with my business. And I wouldn't limit that to Sam Altman. I think any platform you should not trust if it's a closed platform. And that's why about 60-70% of the people who are building with ChatGPT in a study recently that was shared with me said they were planning on moving to open source when open source catches up. The way open source is going to catch up is when brave people say, you know what, I'm going to give up the 6-month lead that I get with ChatGPT and I start investing in the open source project. So this is a great mitzvah that Zuckerberg has done for the world in taking a very powerful model and making it open source. So please support that and then make sure he doesn't put any cuffs on it, right? Like these open source projects, there was a little flare up between WP Engine and WordPress this weekend. there can be some kerfluffles here. There's another kerfluffle going on with a YC-backed company that forked an open source project and got funded for it and was like, it's our project now, bitches, basically. So there can be little kerfluffles in the open source world, but generally you can fork your way out of them if you don't like what the, you know, the leaders are doing in those projects. So please support open source. Yeah.
I think I saw this. Was that the company in the latter case, Pear AI, which is being built by the guy Frying Pan on Twitter?
Correct. And I guess it, you know, he basically, YC funded the project, they forked it. And I guess there's like a smoking gun of a tweet where he says, it's like, this project's ours now. We're funded. We're NYC. So just like, listen, we pick founders because of their effervescent nature. That's a kind way of saying they're lunatics. In the best instances, they're lunatics who will do whatever it takes to win.
Yeah.
That's what we're self-selecting for, folks. I'm sorry. I have no Fs left to give. I made my money. I'm more famous and have more influence than I ever thought I would ever have in my life. I'm just going to tell it to you straight here. Founders are selected by Y Combinator by their ability to break rules.
Yes.
And I don't want to say commit crimes, but being a rebel is the goal of coming to YC or even our programs. Now, that doesn't mean we endorse breaking the law.
No.
But it does mean that there's a reason why they put Sam Altman in charge of Y Combinator. Y Combinator and Paul Graham specifically likes the rule breakers who you have to go clean up after. In my personal experience, when I knocked stuff over, sometimes Sequoia had to come and clean up stuff that I did in the market. And I think we kind of like people like that to back, because the people who are trying to be liked or follow the rules generally do not go as far as the rule breakers. I think Steve Jobs made a commercial. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also, it reminds me of a really nice quote that, you know, I think has been shared widely, which is well-behaved women rarely make history. And I think that point is definitely made in a feminist context, but it applies very specifically here. If you are well-behaved, the best you can become is a VP at McKinsey.
There you go.
I mean,
you know, Airbnb's like, okay, you can't have a hotel out of your house, but nothing says you can't take a donation from a friend for renting them your couch.
There you go.
Okay, let's take it to court and find out. And that's how society moves forward. So I have a high tolerance for the rule breakers, benders.
Yeah.
I don't want people doing unethical fraud. That's like where I draw the line. And I deal with that 1 out of 100. I've probably had 4 instances in my entire career. I put 1 or 2 of them in the book Angel. I'll put 3 or 4 of them as composites. I make a composite, like here's a little storytelling time.
Yeah.
Of those. But man, I see people like literally commit what I would consider and the SEC would consider or attempt to do things that I would consider just outright fraud, like fraud in Delaware court system, fraud by the SEC. And when you're a shareholder in those situations, you got to extract yourself, right? So important discussion to have with your mentors in the space of, are you bending rules? Are you reinterpreting rules? Are you committing fraud? And generally, the people committing fraud are just bad actors who know they are. The people
Yes.
who are bending rules are trying to move society forward. And if you can always tell, you can always tell by what's that term? It's a Latin term, like key benefit, who benefits?
Qua bono.
Qua bono.
That's bono? My Italian Latin, C-O-C-U-I space bono. Who benefits?
Yeah. Who benefits? If the public benefits because Lyft got you a cheaper ride and they created the category of ride sharing and sidecar, those two really get credit for it, not Uber. They created it first. Uber reacted to it. When I interviewed Travis at the All In Summit, he actually talked about that. And
yep.
The second is like Airbnb. Who benefits? The homeowner and the guest benefit. And then you're like, oh, I guess there's a little marketplace fee for Uber and a marketplace fee for Airbnb. But in context, it feels like they benefit last and the consumer and the seller benefit first and foremost.
Yeah. I think we can do a naval-based summary of your point about founders. So no one wants to back someone in the Navy because their process, old-fashioned, top-down, blah, blah, blah. and you don't want to do a full pirate because they don't care about the rules and they'll just sink your ship. Maybe like an aggressive privateer, you know, like right down there, you know, definitely out there for the gold, but knows how to follow a rule or two, and therefore you won't end up in a fraud situation.
Boba Fett is not taking on the Empire. He's not taking on the Rebellion. He's picking up packages. He's delivering them to the highest bidder, whether it's Jabba, whether it's Darth Vader, and that's it. And he's done. Just going to do a couple of jobs.
I need to watch The Mandalorian. Like Bounty Hunters. I still need to watch that show. Can we just do a quick sidebar on OpenAI? Because you brought up Sam Altman and all that. So I have a little argument that I want to throw at you. I think it can be argued that OpenAI is cheap at $150 billion. And the reason why is Reuters reported that the company, now at a $3.7 billion run rate, expected to have $3.4 billion in actual earned revenue this year, not as a run rate calculation. The company says that it expects, and this is per their reporting, $11.6 billion in 2025 revenue, which against a $150 billion valuation is only about a 13x next year's revenues, which isn't that expensive, I don't think, for a company that's going to grow by over 200% in the next year if it hits its targets. So to me, I kind of get the number now, Jason. The thing that I'm confused about is how do they expect to grow by like, what, $8 billion next year if you and I both think that open source AI models have as much traction as they do and will have in the future? So if they hit their numbers, cheap. If they don't, ugh.
Yeah. So I'll give the Vinod quote. Those are just details. He said that like at last year's All In Summit when we interviewed him, when I was asking him about the nonprofit versus price, like those are just details. Well, details are what matter. I think I'll give you the bull bear case. Yeah. According to me,
yeah.
The bear case, I think, is that Siri, Google search, Android, and browsers and social media apps are going to intercept 90% of queries, 95% of queries. And that the only people who are going to go to a dedicated AI app like ChatGPTs, which you and I are addicted to and mm-hmm. I use all day, are, you know, just really high-end users. And that those products will be free by big iron. Amazon, Meta, Microsoft, and Google can afford to give those products out for free. And what they said about the user base of ChatGPT is that when they allowed people to use it without logging in, their user base went bonkers.
Yep.
And which is Google, right? You don't have to log in to use Google. So they follow Google there. I think what's going to happen is we might experience peak consumer usage of ChatGPT during this time period. And then people will say, why am I paying 20, 30, 40 bucks a month for this when it's built into my iPhone? No, you and I will not.
True.
Because 500 bucks a year to do our jobs better, and corporations might not, seems like a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
Right. And I actually pay for the professional version for everybody on our team.
Yep.
So we're paying 20 bucks times, I don't know what the corporate is. Maybe it's 30 bucks a month. So 600, I'm probably giving $7,000 mm-hmm. a year for our small firm to use ChatGPT. And I would never stop if it was but 10% better than the other products out there. Mass consumers, however, do not pay for calendar apps.
It's true. Or email.
They don't pay for calculators or flashlights.
Yeah.
They don't. They don't pay for notepad apps. So when people pitch us those, we're like, what's your plan here? And they're like, well, we're going to be like Evernote. And it's like, okay, you Evernote had its window.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people saw like an easy to use notepad in the cloud. And then notepad on your phone became part of the cloud and everything else became free. So yeah, I think the API calls for OpenAI are 70% of the revenue, 80% of the revenue, according to reports, and the consumer fees are 20 to 30%.
Yeah.
So I think they're an enterprise company and their partner is Microsoft for enterprise. And Oracle, Apple are not going to give their business to Sam Altman. And I think you're starting to see cracks in the Sam Altman deal-making, which, let's be honest, he might be the Barry Diller of our generation right now. He might be the Mike Ovitz of our generation. To the point at which it's almost comical, right? Like people are like, my God, is there anything this person can't convince somebody to do? He convinced Elon Musk to give him $50 million for a nonprofit and had absolutely no problem flipping it into a for-profit. He has no problem going to the Middle East and saying, it's going to be $7 trillion. He apparently went to TSMC and all these incredible people and said, yeah, I just need like $7 trillion to build 30 fabs. And they're like, who's this podcast, bro? It's become like almost like a meme. Like,
hey,
this guy could come in and just literally take your shirt off your back and you would give him $20 and get sunburned. And then he would charge you for like sunburn lotion cream after doing that. So shout out Sam. He's incredible. But that can only take you so far, I think. And I think we might see the limit of that. Apple is not participating in the OpenAI funding, I read. And then Apple had ChatGPT in their Apple Intelligence.
Yep.
Okay. I think Tim Cook came to his senses. We'll use you. We won't give you money. We'll use you. We'll learn from you. We'll use it as a bridge. But ain't no way we trust an OpenAI. You lose that many team members. You do all this fugazi behavior. These big iron providers are going to, I think, rethink their relationship with specifically Sam.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they trust him. And I know the startups don't trust him. So,
wait.
I mean, trust matters.
Yeah. Jason, is this the bull case or the bear case?
I don't know where I was. I think it's the, I think it's like the bull case for Sam's like the greatest deal maker of the century. Got and it. The bear case for when you can take that too far in life.
Okay.
I do think they'll be one of the top three players. But I do think Microsoft, Google, and Apple, and Amazon, and Oracle are not going to empower OpenAI any further. I think they're realizing they may have created a monster.
Okay, we all want to build products that users love, and we all understand in the startup game, it's product market fit that is the goal. But increasing conversions and boosting engagement, well, you got to really understand your users in order to do that, right? And that's something you're not going to get just from analytics. Well, let me tell you about Sprig. It's a product experience platform that generates AI-powered opportunities to continuously improve your product at scale. Here's how it works. Sprig captures your product experience in real time, and they do this with heat maps, replays, surveys, and feedback studies. So you put all that together, right? You're seeing where people are clicking. You're watching how they're using your app or your product. Then Sprig's industry-leading AI instantly analyzes all of your product experience data to generate real-time insights, providing actionable product recommendations. That's going to allow you to drive revenue, increase retention, whatever your goals are, and most of all, improve user satisfaction with your product. So see why top product teams at Figma and Notion are already using Sprig's AI to unlock new opportunities at scale. Visit sprig.com/twist to book a demo and get a $75 gift card. That's sprig.com/twist.
I want to ask this question, flipping around kind of what you're saying. Is it possible to build the next $1 trillion technology company without owning your own iron? Can you build a $1 trillion company based off of someone else's data centers?
Not in the short term, because all the iron's been accounted for. So in this window, in this Game of Thrones, you have to have the coin to buy the most dragons and or scorpion, you know, things that shoot the dragons down, right? This is a game of dragons, a game of tanks, a game of pick the arena. You know, you either need to have the best gladiators, the best battleships, the best fighter planes, whatever it is. And in this battlefield, that happens to be data centers. And so you, whoever has the energy, the nuclear power plant, the NVIDIA chips or other chips wins. And I think the key thing to look at here is I think Sam might get outgunned because they're losing $5 billion a year and they're making $3.5 billion. Now, that's according to reports.
Yes.
Sometimes people get burn rate and spend confused. All right, there's three numbers when you're looking at a startup. Revenue, spend, you do the math on those two numbers and you get to your burn rate. They're saying they're burning $5 billion and they're making $3.6 billion. Am I correct in what the press reports are?
3.7, but let's not fight about that. Sure. But yes, you're in the exact ballpark.
Okay. And they say the burn is $5 billion.
Yep.
Burning per year, $5 billion. They're raising $6 billion or so, $5 to $6 billion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much cash they got on them. This startup might have a less than a year of runway. Is that what I'm reading into this? That they have 3 months of runway, 6 months of runway? And they need another $6 billion to make it through the next year? Is that what's happening here with OpenAI?
Depends a lot on how fast the revenue ramps. And we are dealing with run rate numbers, and we are also dealing with expected end of year totals.
Okay. So we've confirmed 3.7 million run rate. We've confirmed losing $5 billion according to press reports. There, we've confirmed this is going to be a $5 or $6 billion raise.
Yes.
How much cash is left in the bank would be the question you want to ask. And if they're burning, let's say $5, $6 billion, they're burning, holy cow, $500 million a month?
Just under.
That's a lot of money. So if you're burning $400 million a month and they have 1,000 employees, those 1,000 employees or two, they have 1,000 employees, I think is the number.
The last I heard was 1,700?
Okay, so 2,000 at 500,000 apiece. You know, you start doing some math here for the first billion. That means $4 billion in data center, electric, legal, whatever. But let's just call it four. Maybe $1 billion in salaries and comp for that team. They were incredibly highly paid, which I think they are. And then you put $4 billion for, you know, Big Iron, which makes sense because what's NVIDIA's revenue? Back NVIDIA's revenue into, you know, one of their biggest customers, XAI, Microsoft, Google, Apple, like, these are all the big customers. So
yeah,
I think there's like an I'm not going to say an existential crisis here, but they're having a hard time keeping up, I think.
So I would read these numbers slightly less worriedly. And here's why. The company was so much smaller at the start of the year in revenue terms that presuming they had a similar amount of compute costs, they were burning way more capital in January than they were in July. So I think their pace of losses should decelerate. And given their expected growth, I think also we could see them become, on an operating margin basis, quite a lot less unprofitable. That said, even if they cut their burn in half, burning $2.5 billion a year is still $200 million a month, or what is that, like $6, $7 million a day? It's still an enormous amount of money. So I don't want to diminish the burn. I would be shocked if they're still at that pace of burn at the end of this calendar year. And with that much money in the bank, they have probably more than 12 months of runway, but I wouldn't say it's more than 2 years.
Unless
it's not infinite.
Unless they need to increase their spend to keep up with Amazon, Microsoft, and Apple, and Google. I have a feeling that they need to increase their spend. So your theory would be correct.
Yes.
If they didn't, you know, that the revenue is increasing and they're not going to spend as much on data center, right? So you have these two lines, revenue's increasing, right? And then the cost of the data centers, which is the cost of this business, right? It's not the 2,000 employees. Really, it's the data center cost, which is a new experience here for startups. And this isn't really a startup if they're making this much money. So, you know, I think this could be a serious challenge. Let's say they do have to invest another 10, 20 billion in data centers, which I think they do at a minimum. If they've got to invest another 20 billion in data centers, and they're at $150 billion. They're only, the $6 billion they're raising right now is only diluting them 4%, 5%. If they raise $20 billion at $200 billion, now they're diluting 10%. Yeah, this cap table is going to be fascinating to look at, but this is a lot of chaos for one startup to be dealing with concurrently. All these people leaving, lawsuits, competitors, cash crunch or massive investment, one or the other, you know, or both, and open source. This is high stakes. This is a high, I would not make this investment.
Yeah, no, you said that before, which is why I wanted to bring up the new revenue projection for next year. But it's interesting because we were talking about, you know, can you build the next $1 trillion company without owning essentially your own mass network of data centers and several nuclear power plants? The answer kind of feels like no. And to me, what that means is that the ownership of digital brains, data centers, and power, which is just heat, essentially, boils water, makes steam, spins stuff around, but it's always the same process. So basically, heat and smart sand, if you don't have mass capacity for those, you're kind of DOA. And that makes me kind of worried about startups, because a lot of them are, they're cloud dependent from day one. So how can they really challenge the big iron companies if big iron itself is so big?
The answer to the question is they're not going to compete with them on this battlefield. This is not the arena that they will compete with them. Just like you don't see startups competing in the arena of hard disks or storage or cloud computing. Like, when's the last time we had a cloud computing startup? Like, the last volley was like Rackspace 20 years ago, right? So the arena is not going to be storage or data centers. It's going to be verticalized apps. And if it's true that the open source movement is working, taking open source and having proprietary data and building something very niche and bespoke, I think is where startups win. Just like YouTube and Dropbox did not win based on their hard drives. And Dropbox tried, right? Dropbox built their own data centers. They thought that would be a technological advantage and they could never use Amazon's S3 or whatever. And they wound up, I think, doing exactly that and getting rid of their own data centers eventually. So there was an argument. This argument reminds me of like owning fiber. Like, Google was going to own all this fiber. Google was going to own, and other purple people felt they needed to own the hard disk space. YouTube didn't, Dropbox did. So yeah, I think this all gets abstracted away and commodified very quickly. And that's the other danger for OpenAI, is they need to make money off of these products and services. Microsoft and Google do not, and Apple certainly doesn't. So Apple could take all the margin, and Apple Intelligence is free, and they use Llama, and they join forces with Facebook, or they buy some small Anthropic-like company, and they start their own open source project. And all Apple needs to do is make Siri work for what they said it would work for the last 10 years. And I think they intercept half of all AI queries.
Right. And then the question becomes, do they build a competing search engine to what Google has put together? Because why would you share when you could have it for yourself? I know there's a lot of money involved, but long term, I think you'd rather own more of the consumer than own a near-term portion of Google's cash flows. So,
and to add to that, there's a legal case that the default that Google has, is an antitrust issue. And that was my prediction here on the program, was eventually Apple will have a lightweight search engine. I believe they should just buy the Brave search engine or DuckDuckGo or both. And those are tiny little tuck-in, under $1 billion acquisitions that would be transformative and they would be good for competition. So if you're listening, Lina Khan, in your last 90 days, oh wait, you're out of here, in your last 6 months.
I hope she gets a job in the next administration because I want to see the blood vein in your forehead explode on camera.
She's going to be a guest on here. I guarantee she's working for Andreessen Horowitz. I'm calling it now. She won't be accepting a job at Andreessen or Founders Fund or I'll give you the, here's my odds. Y Combinator, okay. Andreessen, Founders Fund. One of those three she'll work at.
I would 80% YC, 10% Andreessen, 5% Founders Fund, and then after that, but I think it's going to be 5%
a law firm.
Hasn't she gone to YC twice already?
Yeah, she's getting up in YC. I think she wants to be a partner. She's young. She's in her 30s. She hasn't made money yet.
I love when you say young and you're
30s. No, you're closer to 40. She's closer to 30. So you're very old. And look at yourself. Look in the mirror. I mean, you're a dad. I saw the pictures of you running around with that baby strapped to your chest. Super cute.
Should have seen how much baby spit I had on this part of my body in the last 24 hours. It's been
nothing like dealing with baby liquids all over your body all the time.
Dude, yeah. We don't have time to go off topic about it, but no. I've had way too much baby liquid in my life. So Bloomberg has a story talking about AR and VR and headsets and efforts, Jason. I'm a long-term bull on AR and VR, but a short-term pessimist. But it seems that the winds might be changing. So we have some clips coming up, but start with why this story is buzzing in your bonnet.
Well, false starts, as we've talked about, are part of technology. And so we've had a false start on AR and VR. And I thought I would take folks to the graveyard of startups because there is an important thing with timing. When you are going to be part of a platform revolution, whether it's AI or it's augmented reality or virtual reality, consumers have to be ready for it. The platform has to be ready. So if we were to look at, for example, AI, there were AI startups 4 years ago using ChatGPT like 1.5, 2, 2.5, and some of those didn't survive to get to ChatGPT 3.5 and consumers embracing this technology and the technology not spitting out garbage. And so here we are. You can do something like TaxGPT or any number of generative AI startups or co-pilots, and they actually work well enough that people are willing to pay for them. Congratulations. The timing of that from inception and like the platform being built out seems like it was about 36 months. Okay, let's compare and contrast that to AR, VR. Augmented reality. I used to do a conference with TechCrunch called TechCrunch 50. Here is a company called TonchiDot that made a camera. And when the first iPhone added a camera, they demoed this demo. If you haven't seen it, we're just going to play the video here. And we'll go into the startup graveyard. It's very scary. Ooh, insert scary graphic here. And so here we go. We'll play this video. And what you'll see is this video is really low res because it was done, I think, 20 years ago at TechCrunch 50, the event I used to co-host and I created with Mike Arrington at TechCrunch. He was a bombastic writer who you don't know anymore if you're a young person. But here's the iPhone. That's the original, yeah, with the hard thing. So you can see the original iPhone was the size of a pack of cigarettes or an iPod. And let's just hit play here and we'll pause it when I say pause. But you got somebody going down with the Seeky camera. And this was TonchiDot. This is from TechCrunch 50 in 2009, 15 years ago. And you see he's clicking on items on the menu in a restaurant and getting like a Yelp-like experience.
Yep.
And it's augmented reality without glasses. And then, you know, he's looking at things in a museum and seeing the details that would normally, you know, be on the Wikipedia page for a piece of artwork with his phone. And so, and then here, the great example of like, I'm at the subway and I'm trying to get information. So this startup, 16 years ago, 2009, 15 years ago, and they're talking about like how the technology for shopping would work, et cetera. And the really cool feature was you could post an audio comment on anything in the real world. So if you saw, I don't know, let's say you were at a monument, you're at the Eiffel Tower and you want to just leave a message, you could leave a message there for your friend was the idea. When your friend comes and they would get an alert, hey, I left this for, you know, my friend at the Eiffel Tower. Really weird idea. But here we are. This is from the startup graveyard. You would leave messages. So remember, this is during the social revolution when messaging was like a big deal. Like Twitter had just emerged in 2009, Facebook, et cetera. And so no keywords, no search. You just watch the world was what they were saying at the event. And that you could leave messages for your friends. That was a weird one. Or you could leave items for your friends, like a little teddy bear, almost like an emoji. So that was Seek AI camera. See the AI in there? And it was by a company, TonchiDot. And this video of them presenting brought the house down because it was so revolutionary. Were you there by chance, Alex?
I actually was there. Because I remember Red Beacon winning and they had the cupcake delivery at during the finals pitching.
Yeah.
And I think this is the one that Bing sponsored all the bars and didn't card me. And I blacked out on the way home.
Anyways,
to be young and stupid.
It's a different era.
Oh, for me, especially. Yes. Little baby, dumb Alex. Don't take him seriously. But the point is, I remember this demo line and I do remember it bringing down the house and people were so excited about it because it was a way that melded the digital and the real. And it felt like finally there was going to be a stitch between them and your phone was going to, I guess, mediate this, we'd say now.
Yes.
But it was a fusion of two things that had been distinct before and people were hype. And then we never talked about it again.
And then we never talked about it again. And then Google Glass came out shortly after this. We'll show a picture of Google Glass in a moment. And then we had this demo at Le Web. Le Web was a conference my friend Loïc Lemaire used to do. It was originally called Le Blogs, and it was in France. And then it became Le Web, which became like the TechCrunch 50 of Europe. And so here we'll play. And this is AR Nav, an augmented reality startup from Le Web in 2011. And what you see is a tablet. These Android tablets became a thing.
And the concept was you would hold up your tablet, and here it's showing you, you can hit play, walking through little squares as if you were in a Tron light cycle, and it's giving you augmented instructions of Google Maps. And, you know, the dialogue here is kind of funny because they're just talking about all the technological limitations. What's the processor speed in there? How does it work in this demo? But you can see the things that we now have on Apple Watches or in Google Maps. And this is where they started. A long-winded way, again, of saying you got to time your startup correct. And so the question I'm going to put up here, Alex, is these chunky glasses, Apple goggles, are now... the chunky AR glasses that Apple showed are not available. They're outrageously expensive. The ones, the spectacles that are made, here's Google Glass, and you see Mark Andreessen, John Doerr, and the guy in the middle is from Google Ventures. You'll come to me in a second.
I know him as that guy from GV I used to talk to.
Bill Maris, I believe. Somebody will fact check me there. And here they are. Google created $100 million venture fund, and this was the announcement of it. And they all wore these glasses. These glasses just had that little thing that a little object on the top right, as you can see, that would project into one of your eyes some like alerts. So just imagine like the notification window being there. So you can leave these on and it would give you notifications in the real world, like Google directions. So this was a stop along the way. Google got it right. Tonchi Doc got it right. This navigation, they all got it right, but they're no longer here. And so a big part of running a startup is having the runway, the fortitude as the founders to survive long enough for the revolution to arrive, or to be smart enough to sell your company and cash out before, you know, you run out of money, which Oculus actually did that. My good friend, Palmer Luckey, a friend of the pod. Palmer sold Oculus, you know, really for a couple of $1 billion. Would that company have survived on its own? Well, Magic Leap.
No.
Well, did Magic Leap survive? I don't know. You know,
no.
Okay. So this is back to the big boy and the big girl game, right? The big table. This is the big poker table. You're going to have $50 billion, which is what I think Meta spent on these things so far. And I'm sure that's what Apple spent, 10 or 20 billion on their goggles. And we're still 5 years away from it being a reality. So the question for you, Alex, is, and I'll just get your general reaction on the startup graveyard concept here and your memories of it, is now the time to create apps for AR?
I want a 3-month mulligan on that question to see how the new Quest 3S headset sells. So this is the new Meta headset. And the reason why I care is it's $300, okay, which is finally at that kind of like high quality, low price combination that I think the AR VR world has been waiting for. And now Oculus definitely more VR than AR. But it's funny how much of stuff that is amazing isn't always a great business. And if you recall the Google Glass days, they had the little translation app. And so you could look at a street sign and it would auto translate it for you. I got to play with that, blew my mind. I also got to play with the Microsoft HoloLens, which was AR, blew my mind. And I never got to play with Magic Leap, but I'm sure I would have loved it. And so it's funny how so many things that I don't like to use, like Concur, kind of just like stay alive in the world of technology. And some things that were so great didn't quite make it. But I think we've now reached the point when the hardware's gotten good enough. There's enough good apps. I don't want to shoot myself in the foot and have someone clip this in 5 years and mock me. But yeah, I think we're probably about the point when AR and VR are going to have enough consumer buy-in to be worth building on top of.
Yeah. So here we are. And, you know, there was a little mini VR revolution when Oculus got bought by Facebook and everybody thought, well, now that's part of Facebook and he's gone all in on it. There's going to be 1 billion people with these headsets. And therefore, if I capture 1% of 1 billion, I got 10 million people paying me whatever, $10 a year, a month, whatever. And, you know, it's obviously not happened, but there are some number of people using this technology every day. It's nowhere near smartphone penetration. So then I guess the next question for you, Alex, is do you want AR glasses? Do you want, when we're talking here, notes coming up, instant messages coming in, your DoorDash order, your Amazon arrivals, all kinds of notifications, the Knicks trading for Karl-Anthony Towns coming in on your glasses all the time.
Do you want that future? Do you want to be with your baby wearing your glasses and having ding, 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 ding while you're looking at your baby?
So look at my wrists. There's no longer an Apple Watch on them. I didn't charge it one day and I took it off and I just said, this is better. Because do you know what I got was every single Slack you sent me would ping my watch and it was so annoying. But I was a new employee, so I was trying to make sure that I was super engaged and responsive and all that. But what it did was just make me anxious all the time because my watch would do Substack notifications and emails and Slack and go away. I think that if we allow the notification creep of the current mobile world to persist into AR and VR, it's going to be a garbage technology. I don't think we should take the existing model and put it over there. But when it comes to unlocking the world for me as someone who only speaks a couple languages, awesome. Someone who likes to game and wants to have a better, bigger screen, awesome. There's a lot of things that work there. I just don't want it to become another slate for notifications, which becomes essentially an advertising vector, as anyone who uses Uber Eats knows.
I think it's really well said. I do not want these glasses in society. And I've given it a lot of thought.
That's a big statement. Come on.
It's a big statement. I think the reason I object to these most is that right now we are just trying to come to a reasonable amount of manners for looking at your phone. So I was at dinner and I was at the Minetta Tavern, very nice place. And when I was, I went to New York for a couple of days to see my dad. Shout out my dad. And I had my phone on the table and my friend said, would you put the phone in your pocket? And I said, okay. He said, it's not you. When I see your phone, it triggers that I should check my phone. And I was like, fair enough. And I put my phone away. And then I am on the cusp. Now that I'm like really focused on my sleep with my 8 sleep, I get my score every day. I'm really focusing on my sleep because when I find I don't sleep well and I get a low sleep score, 40, 50, 60, even 70, I'm just not as good on air. I'm not as good on email. I'm not as crisp. When I get 80 or 90, man, I really feel the difference. So the 8 sleep is keeping me accountable. And I took the dogs out of the bed. I took eating late at night out of the bed. I had a little more discipline with caffeine after 3 or 4 o'clock. I'm getting in the bed earlier and then the smartphone's the last piece. And I'm actually thinking I'm going to do a week trial of leaving the smartphone out of the room or in the drawer or on the stand. My typical nighttime thing is to just listen to a podcast and or an audiobook and it helps me go to sleep. But I'm going to try something else. My point being, these things are going to start this whole cycle over. It's going to be another 10 years of us being at dinner or being at the playground or being at a concert and everybody holding up their phones and recording each other and not just being in the moment. I want to be in the moment. There are specific situations like translating. There are specific situations like taking a picture of my kids. There are situations like skiing where I want to know my speed and what the trails are or walking around Tokyo. I could see specific applications, but I literally don't want to live in a society where these glasses have a camera on them. I think they should be banned and the pendant should be banned in public spaces where people don't want them the same way cigarettes are. And I think that's where society will get to. If you're a bar, if you're a restaurant, if you're a school, phones should go in the bags on the way into school, just like they do at concerts, like in comedy halls. And I think these pendants and glasses, if you put them on, because if you take your phone out and you take a picture in a private club, Soho House, or whatever, you lose your membership. It's that simple. None of that. And then they also have like a time period where you can use your devices and you can't. So at the private club in the Battery in San Francisco, their rule was at 5:30, laptops and phones could not be out in the bar area of the restaurant. Couldn't have them out. If you had to take it, there were phone booths you could go to. And it just made the place awesome to hang out at. And so anyway, that's what I hope. I've been to some parties with high profile people in my life where they collect everybody's phones at the door. Best parties I've been to. And so these glasses are going to destroy another generation's ability to communicate with each other. And they're going to make everything miserable again.
We're going to have another live news show on, I think it's Wednesday, Jason, because there's a lot of stuff that we're not going to be able to get to. But sure. Here's a hypothesis based on what you just said, because I agree And I wonder if it's going to become the new way of determining class. Because if you think about old clubs, you know, you had to be a certain person, certain last name, certain socioeconomic status.
Gender, ethnicity, caste system.
Famously, the what's the club on top of San Francisco, on top of the hill? There was one that no one can join.
No idea.
By Grace Cathedral. It's like
they never let me join.
Well, yeah, they said no women, no Democrats, no journalists, which I thought was the funniest. Like,
yeah, just in that order.
I don't recall if it was that order, but that's how clubs used to be, right? Now, though, you mentioned Soho House, you mentioned the Battery. I would say slightly less impossible to get into, but with stricter rules about how you act kind of once you're inside. And I wonder if we're going to look at clubs as...
Oh, Bohemian Club.
Thank you. Like digital deserts as a feature, as a perk. Mm. And yes. There's a club nearby where I live called the Hope Club, and I was just trying to find the rules for it, but I couldn't find it in time. But I'm pretty sure they probably have a low phone policy at a minimum. And I wonder if that's going to become the thing people seek out and really invest in, because I don't want more pictures. I know we're on YouTube right now, so ha, ha, ha. But like, I don't want more pictures of me and my family taken. I don't mind my face being out there because whatever. But, you know, I'm with you on this. And I think we will need new rules about it. But I want to make one last distinction. You're talking a lot about Google Glass style spectacles, what, you know, Snap is working on, Meta's more Ray-Bans. That stuff I am less bullish on than VR as a concept and a platform. And so I think I'm more bullish on immersive experiences versus augmented experiences.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. Yeah. I think the VR stuff is for like a very subset of people who like almost like hardcore gamers. I think there'll be something that will emerge like hardcore gaming where you have a PC and you care about the weight of your mouse. I think that's VR. And I think AR is the version of casual games. So I think VR is Call of Duty. AR is Angry Birds, Plants and Zombies.
Okay. Well, by, you know, Call of Duty famously has made billions and billions of dollars. So I'll take...
Yeah, both are great businesses.
Yeah.
One of them attracts tens of millions of people. One of them attracts billions. That's all. It's just different. It's just different.
You slap an ARPU on that and we'll see who wins this argument, Jason.
I don't know. Are casual games or... That's a great question because I haven't kept up with it.
I just made...
Casual games or... What do they call them? Title A games or A title games?
Well, AAA is like, AAA, you know, your big games. I play a lot of indie games, but I think I actually made your point for you because casual games can make so much money that I wonder if their ARPU isn't actually higher than hardcore gamers. And so that kind of makes your point. Arguing against myself here. All right, we're going to wrap everybody. We're going to take one audience cue if we have any more. Fusionid HM asks, does Jason have horses now?
Very important question. No horses. We are getting chickens. We did plants and a compost pile. And now we're going to do chickens, donkeys, goats. And then if the girls take to horseback riding, we have two horse barns on the property because it was a horse ranch before I bought it. So, yeah.
No, that's the one thing I've banned from my children is horses because I don't want to have to take care of them. Sebastian, Jason, given the current hype around AI, what key characteristics should startups focus on to build a sustainable moat? I said unique data, but I'm curious what you have to throw in there.
I think data and user experience and brand are going to be the things that will define it. You can use an Excel spreadsheet or a Google sheet to do all kinds of project management, CRM, etc. Right. And so there are templates for Google Sheets or Excel that do project management and that do CRM. And then there's Salesforce and HubSpot. There's Notion and there's Coda and there's Asana and all these incredible tools. 37 Signals, what's their famous project, Basecamp. So, you know, you can, you know, win by having verticalized software. And I think luxury software, which is superhuman, kind of define the category, is going to increasingly become a thing. So if there was a version of Zoom that was the elite bespoke version of Zoom that had, let's say, 10 times the bandwidth per person and redundancy, and, you know, just allowed for a crisper experience. And, you know, I don't know if that would be the vector under which the speed or just had better quick keys and better features and better recording, you know, people might go to that. For example, there's something called Descript that a lot of podcasters are using now to build a transcript and edit stuff. Now, you don't need that for transcription. You could use the YouTube transcript, but the Descript one's better. You can use editing software, audio editing software, whatever. But people seem to like to pay for Descript, which I would put in the luxury software category, even if the price isn't luxurious right now. So I think brand matters. And I think UX and design matters. And I think training data, to your point, really matters. And you don't need to be that much better than what's available for free. You need to build trust in your brand. I think a really good example of that might be some of the website builders. Squarespace is the perfect example. I've used Squarespace for over 10 years. They're a partner of the program as well because they knew I used it. When you use a Squarespace website, like every year they gift you 20 new features. It doesn't change the price. They're just like, oh, by the way, you can sell content and memberships now. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So you've added like a version of Patreon's, you know, software or whatever, you know. And at some point, you know, people just add features like this and you're like, ah, I trust that this is not going away and that they'll keep adding features if I need them. That's a really interesting concept, I think, for startups to think about. It's a really good question. So trust in the brand.
I think it's also a question that every VC in the world is trying to answer right now. And I don't think anyone has the absolute, you know, be all end all answer. All right, but we got to go. Friends, we do live news quite often. So if you're not following us on YouTube, like us, subscribe us, hit the bell, I believe. If you're listening on a podcast app, we love you just the same. You're all fantastic. I'm Alex. That's Jason, @Alex, @Jason over on X/Twitter. We'll see you all soon. Bye.